Well, for the next 5 weeks, we're going to be looking at three chapters in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5-7, often referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. And it's called that because it consists of a series of Jesus' teachings that he gave while sitting on a mountain. And I've never come across a biblical scholar who would question whether or not these things were actually spoken by Jesus. But I have come across a few that question whether or not it actually occurred in this setting. You know, if you look at some of the other Gospels, and you can kind of get the sense of where they're coming from, but they suggest that what Matthew has done is taken a collection of Jesus' sayings and compiled them to present in this sermon format as kind of a general summary of Jesus' teachings for new followers of Jesus. And so whether you agree with that or not, it's not really relevant per se, but assuming that's true, there are certain things that Matthew does, details that he gives us, that he wants us to understand about this Sermon on the Mount. And so the first thing is that it happens very early in Jesus' public ministry. So as you're looking at the story of Jesus, we've seen the temptation of Christ. We've seen him call his disciples. He's been teaching. He's been spreading his message in the synagogues and on the street corners. And he's been healing people. He'd been casting out demons, healing people of disease, doing things like this. And so it's like he's gained this following now. And so now he wants to kind of lay out for them what he's all about. And so one person compared this. They said this is kind of like Jesus' inaugural address. And maybe you've heard that term too much in the last couple weeks. And I'm sure that the Pharisees understated the crowd. I'm sure the disciples overstated the crowd, but it doesn't really matter. It's Jesus, right? So it's worth listening to. The second thing that Matthew tells us, this happened on a mountain. And so mountains are huge for the Jewish faith. Significant things happen on mountains. The transfiguration of Jesus would be one, and we're going to look at that in a few months. But then also the story of Elisha calling down fire from heaven and proving the prophets of Baal to be false. But what Matthew wants us to think of is the story of Moses going up the mountain and receiving the law, because he understood Jesus to be the fulfillment of that law. And so what Jesus is about to say and to teach represents the fullest and the most complete understanding of what the law was really all about. But the third thing Matthew wants us to notice is that Jesus sat down. And this was the typical posture taken by a Jewish rabbi when he would begin to teach. And so Matthew's writing to a primarily Jewish audience, and they would have understood that when a rabbi sat down, if you're a disciple of that rabbi, it's time to listen. It's time to focus on what he's about to say. And so we're going to start at the beginning in chapter 5 and look at the first 12 verses this morning. So hear the word of the Lord. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him. And then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So as many of you are aware, our church recently started another installment of the Financial Peace University. And we've talked about it a little bit and announced it and so on. And even before the class began, I was ready to give my endorsement. I'd heard a lot of good things about it, and now 2 weeks into the class, I feel even more strongly about the value of this program. And so this is, you could think of this as a shameless plug, but I'm not ashamed of it. But I was thinking about this. If you asked me at the age of 19 how I felt about financial peace, I would have told you it was a horrible idea. I would have said to you it was a big, fat waste of time. Now, this class is designed to provide a biblical perspective on stewardship. And so, with almost an exclusive focus on what that looks like from a financial perspective. And so it encourages things like getting rid of debt, you know, tithing, which pastors are always in favor of, and saving, you know, lots of saving. You know, saving for emergencies, saving for college, saving for retirement. And so to encourage saving, Dave gives these two illustrations, and we're on a first-name basis now, Dave and myself, Dave and I. The first individual is 19 years old. That's where I came up with that number. It's not random. The first guy is 19 years old, and he starts setting aside $2,000 each year for retirement and does this until the age of 26 and then stops for the rest of his life. Then this other individual starts at the age of 27, setting aside the exact same amount of money every year until the age of 65. And by the time they both retire, the first guy has over twice as much money in retirement. And that's because of like compounding interest and a lot of other things that I don't fully understand. Joey could explain to you. But you get the point. It's better to start early. And as someone who is now the ripe old age of 37, that was just very depressing news, you know, because it is too late for me. You know, but I'm going to encourage my children to do it because they have to have money so they can take care of me. Because that's what I'm planning on. That's my retirement plan, is my two children. But then I think, what if at the age of 19, they think, like I would have thought, that advice is crazy. You know, at the age of 19, I wasn't thinking about retirement. You know, at the age of 19, I was thinking about, never mind. And some things never change. No. So, as far as money was concerned, I wasn't thinking about retirement. You know, to me, it made a lot more sense to spend money on other things. You know, maybe new clothes, going out to eat with friends, putting together a really nice sound system in my car. You know, those things were important. They mattered. Not boring stuff, you know, like having food and shelter when I'm old. I wasn't really concerned about those things. In those days, I never would have listened to Dave Ramsey. But the way that I imagine a 19-year-old me would have felt about the advice that he gave is the way many people feel toward Jesus' words in this first part on the Sermon on the Mount. You know, I don't know about you, but when I look at those teachings, these statements about the kind of people that Jesus wants his disciples to be and the kind of things that he wants his disciples to do, they don't make a whole lot of sense. You know, as one person said, most of these are almost exactly opposite to common wisdom. And the name that we've given to these statements is, of course, the Beatitudes. You're familiar with that term, which means that they're statements describing God's blessing or God's favor. And each one follows the same basic formula: you are blessed if you do this. And so this would suggest that there's some benefit to these things, but it's kind of hard to see it. You know, the first thing Jesus says is, blessed are the poor. And this could mean being poor literally, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun. But then the addition of these words in spirit adds to it this idea of a person who is not arrogant. You know, a person who's humble, a person who's aware of their need for God. And I don't know about you, but it seems like arrogant is the way to go. You know, I think back to my brief career playing sports in high school and then a little bit in college on club teams. I wasn't that good, I'm not going to lie. Arrogance seemed to give people an edge. You know, some of the best athletes I've ever known were extremely arrogant. And that goes over into other areas of life. How does being poor in spirit really have any help to us? And then Jesus said that those who mourn are blessed. You know, even if this referred to just mourning, you know, in the sense of losing a loved one, it wouldn't make a lot of sense, but Jesus means even more than that. He was talking about the way that the people of God are supposed to feel when they look at the way the world is in comparison to the way the world God wants it to be. And basically what he's saying is that the things that break the heart of God, those things should break your heart too. And there is so much suffering and sadness in the world. I mean, it would make anybody miserable to really think about that, to actually dwell on it. It seems so much easier, and it would make far more sense to just kind of look the other way. You know, pretend that it's not really happening, rather than hope for a better world. Jesus said that the meek are blessed. And we don't use the word meek that often. Another word that we could use is gentle. You know, being meek is choosing not to gain power or advantage over someone through violence. It doesn't have to be physical violence. It can mean verbal violence as well. You know, the words that we say can also be violent. But if we're meek, people will walk all over us. I mean, go out to lunch today and order a steak and have them deliver it undercooked and just see how far you'll get if you're meek. You know, I'd really like for you to take it back, please. It usually takes more than that to get what you want. Jesus said that those who hunger and thirst for righteousness are blessed. You know, since righteousness is about doing the will of God, hungering and thirsting for it is about longing for God's kingdom to come, for His will to be done, for all that's bad in the world to be made right again. And how could it be good to long for something that won't happen and who knows how long? You could spend your whole life feeling unfulfilled, feeling uncontent. Jesus said, the merciful are blessed. You know, being merciful is showing undeserved kindness or compassion or forgiveness to someone when it is in your power to punish them or to do otherwise. And if someone does you wrong, it only makes sense that they should pay for what they have done. I mean, how could letting someone get away with something that they have done to you ever be a good thing? And Jesus said, the pure in heart are blessed. By pure in heart, he probably meant not having impure thoughts. I mean, where's the fun in that, right? I'm being sarcastic, if you didn't know, just to clarify that. But he meant having a single-minded devotion to God, which, you know, being devoted to God with all your heart, not having a divided heart, you know, not putting your trust in other things or in other people. But it just doesn't seem wise to do that. You know, to put all of your eggs in one basket, so to speak, when that particular basket is not one that you can even see. Jesus said that the peacemakers are blessed. These are people who refuse to participate in violence. You know, not necessarily passive people, but people who place a priority over reconciliation instead of just handling conflict by getting rid of it. But that seems so much easier. I mean, it is so hard to get along with people who are different than you, who don't think the way that you do. It would make so much more sense to just surround yourself with people who are just like you. Jesus said that those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness are blessed. And these are basically people who suffer in some way because they did the right thing, because they lived the way that God wanted them to live. But just think of how doing the wrong thing can help you get ahead in this life. I mean, how can a righteous person reach their potential and be successful when they're competing on an unlevel playing field, when they're up against people who have no conscience, who have no moral compass? And finally, Jesus said that people who are reviled and persecuted and who have terrible things said about them because of their relationship with Him are blessed. And apparently this is because if this happens, you become part of some exclusive club made up of other people who've experienced those things. And it's hard to understand why someone would want to be a part of that organization. But do you see what I mean? This doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, not to people whose home is in this world, I imagine they'd appreciate it about as much as your typical 19-year-old kid would appreciate advice about saving for retirement. It just doesn't make sense to them. But that's not who Jesus was talking to. He was talking to his disciples. And that should make a world of difference. You see, implicit in this idea of discipleship is the idea of following. You know, really, the two words are synonymous. A follower of Christ is the same as a disciple of Christ. And Jesus' disciples were following him literally, but also metaphorically, into a new way of life, a new way of living, following him into a kingdom that was coming. They weren't living for today. They were living for tomorrow. And with tomorrow in mind, with that future destination, that coming kingdom, these things made perfect sense. You know, Jesus said, the poor in the spirit are blessed because the kingdom will be theirs. Jesus said, those who mourn are blessed because they will be comforted. Jesus said, the meek are blessed because they will inherit the earth. Jesus said, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness are blessed because they will be filled. Jesus said, the merciful are blessed because they will receive mercy. Jesus said, the pure in heart are blessed because they will see God. Jesus said, the peacemakers are blessed because they will be called children of God. Jesus said, the people who are persecuted for righteousness' sake are blessed, for they will receive the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said, the people who are reviled and persecuted and have all kinds of false things said about them on account of Jesus are blessed because it means they have joined the ranks of so many faithful before them and like them will be rewarded for their sacrifice. See, living as a disciple of Jesus only makes sense, complete sense, if you think of it as an investment for the future. It's not at all without benefit in the present. You know, every single one of us could come up with a long list of all the good things in our lives because we are followers of Christ. You know, every single good thing in my life is a result of what Christ has done. And all of us could say the very same thing, but it has to be more than that. As the Apostle Paul said to the Christians in Corinth, if for this life only we have hoped in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. Because hoping in Christ, being a disciple of Christ, doesn't always pay off in this life. This life and the things that make this life worth living could be gone in a moment. What if it were all stripped away? What if today we lost everything? Would we still follow Jesus? Would we still consider ourselves blessed if all we had was our hope in the life that is to come? You know, at this very moment, all across this country, churches and worship leaders and pastors are bending over backwards to make the Bible, to make the gospel relevant. You know, people want advice that will make a difference in their lives today, and the Bible's full of that. It's full of practical wisdom. It's full of insights that can help you do any number of things. But we can't overlook the fact that Jesus, in his Sermon on the Mount, opens with a series of statements that have nothing to do with today as much as they have to do with tomorrow. It doesn't make sense to live as a disciple of Jesus unless you have eternity in mind. And through faith, you'll experience those future blessings in the present. I thought an appropriate response for us this morning to the Word is to reflect upon the ways in which we are and will be blessed. And so I invite you to read along with me a litany